Hey, gang. Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the Jersey barrier of free speech because it keeps you from running off the road. I mean, without a Jersey barrier, you're going to go off the rails and figure out the rest for yourself. So go to republicbroadcasting.org. Click on the donate button, send badly needed fundage. All right, today is Monday. It is Labor Day, and as long as I... All right, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, welcome to the show.
Yes, so happy Labor Day, everyone. Yes, Labor Day, of course, is when we honor, you know, work. We honor labor, which is, you know, mostly manual blue-collar work. And, you know, what do we do on Labor Day? Well, most people, they, you know, have a barbecue and they go on one last vacation before school starts for everybody. All sorts, but, you know, of course, they all forget that the word Labor Day, what is it to honor? It's to honor laborers, to honor workers. And, so we're here, you know, honoring workers, by doing the show and providing them with, information, truth information that they should, hear.
So there's blue-collar work, there's manual labor, that's certainly labor. Of course, there's nowadays, there's an awful lot of non-manual labor that is labor nonetheless. That's, you know, it's not management, it's not getting other people to do things, but, you know, somebody, I don't know, who's managing a database that can, a lot of office work is labor-intensive, even though... you're not getting a good workout while you're doing it. In fact, a lot of those people wind up getting fat, because there's sedentary labor nowadays, but that's just the way it is.
Computer and, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely a good chance of a heart attack working a desk job and vision impairment in the future staring at a computer screen.
But, you know, if you go back 200 years, let's go back 200 years, the the heyday of the Industrial Revolution, and you had people working in the mills, the textile mills or whatever in Manchester, right? Maybe they were bringing coals to Manchester, but these people were working in the mills in Manchester. They burned out really fast. A lot of the work that they were doing, it was repetitive work. They were using the same muscles over and over again. Their bodies became deformed. They, you know, they got all sorts of chronic diseases, respiratory diseases. They got musculoskeletal diseases because of all the repetitive movement, you know, feeding coal into the fire or threading a spindle or whatever the heck they were doing back then. And, you know, one thing, and I don't know how pertinent this is to what we should be talking about today, but even before the Industrial Revolution, you still had a lot of work that was being done in towns, a lot of crafts, a lot of trades that were done in towns. And in Europe, may well have been the same in China, in Asia, but in Europe, you had the cities, London and Paris, were unable to reproduce. The people there were unable to reproduce. The work was such that they would burn out. If they had babies, they couldn't take care of the babies, and the babies would often just be exposed somewhere or left at a church where the church would, you know, just kind of benignly neglect them, the babies, and they die. And the cities had to constantly be replenished with people from the countryside. And the countryside, maybe they were better at reproducing. the countryside might have been better at reproducing, but not always taking care of the bait. They didn't always have the food, depending on how things were going. So you had a constant migration from the countryside to the cities. But you certainly had that. You've had that in China in the 20th century, though, where you had massive movement from the countryside to the cities, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the latter 20th century, after the economic reforms were taking place, you know, a lot of the folks in the countryside, you know, moved to the cities to, you know, for a better life and, you know, for, you know, better jobs and better pay. And yes, many of them did improve their lives as a result. Of course, now, you know, China has a policy where they don't want to forget the countryside, and they're actually going back into the countryside and trying to revitalize the countryside and, you know, keep it in balance with the domination of the cities.
Mm.
So,
and now, of course, China's had a one-child policy. They've had active intervention in reproduction. That having been said, when China was a largely rural society and before this one-child policy, it seemed that the peasants, they had tended to have a lot of children, even if they couldn't always take care of them. And sometimes there were famines, especially under Mao and the Great Leap Forward, there was a massive famine. So you've had that. Nowadays, the country is much more urban. I don't know what the breakdown between rural and urban is now, but the one-child policy has been relaxed, and yet the largely urban population doesn't reproduce. They're not having a lot of kids because, well, cities are kind of crowded, not always the best place to raise kids. What do you think?
Yeah, and also, you know, obviously, the economic prosperity, a lot of the younger Chinese people don't feel a need to have children. And then, of course, you know, them doing their working at their office jobs, a lot of them are focused on their work and they don't have time to have children. Those are the, you know, the two common things you'll hear over there. Of course, you know, the government is trying to change that too, trying to encourage more of them to have children. The bad news is, yeah, China's population is, you know, dropping because of the younger generation not having children, but the good news is, though, it's still got a lot of people, and there's still more Chinese people today than there were, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So,
aren't you worried that the Indian population's going to pass up the Chinese population? Aren't you worried about India passing up?
Of course. I mean, not just for the sake of the Chinese population, but for the sake of the whole world. I mean, India's the dirtiest country in all of Asia. You know, all the waste, all the pollution is all human pollution, you know, compared to China's, you know, industrial pollution, which they are, you know, taking measures to curb. But India's pollution is almost, you know, almost exclusively entirely from the humans themselves that live there. So, yes, I am worried about India's population exploding, and not just India, but Africa's too. I mean, those two parts of the world, Sub-Saharan Africa and India, the Indian subcontinent, are the two most worrying parts, not just for China and Asia, but for the whole world.
Yeah. Now, I've tracked Japan over the past several decades, and in certain ways, you know, people will have said about China, and they also said about Korea, you go to Korea, you go to China, and it looks like Japan 20 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever. You hear this type of thing. And so I've observed the trends in Japan, and will they replicate in Korea or in China? And one thing you saw in Japan regarding the countryside is young women moved out of the countryside. And so who's in the countryside? The average age of a Japanese farmer is, I think, about 72. Okay. So you don't have young farmers, and nobody, you know, when the current generation of farmers retire, nobody wants to take their their place, right? And so farms are being converted to solar farms. I mean, you're seeing this happen. And because people don't want to do agriculture anymore, and the people who are doing it are old and they retire. And one thing that you were seeing for a little while was, I mean, it's especially the women who leave. A lot of the farm boys will stay, but then they don't have wives. And so they started importing wives from the Philippines, which is that really a good long-term solution? So the question is, are you seeing this type of exodus? I mean, there is an exodus from the countryside to the cities. Are you seeing, are you seeing the countrysides becoming increasingly elderly? And B, is there a gender imbalance? Do you know about it?
Well, I mean, you talking about in China?
I'm talking about in China.
In China? I'm not too sure about that. I mean, China, you know, population-wise, has far more men than it does women to begin with. So I'm sure that the countryside is probably going to have more men in it. But, you know, there's still probably a lot of women who stay behind you know, stay with their man, so to speak. I mean, I don't know too much about the, you know, man-woman demographics in the countryside. But I can tell you there's probably going to be more men just because China has more men in general.
Mm-hmm. And which is partly because of the one-child policy and the preference for sons over daughters.
Yeah, because they carry down the last name.
Right.
And other reasons, too.
So there's that. Now, Korea, by the way, you've had some of the same things happen in Korea. One phenomenon you've had in Korea, really, you didn't see in Japan, but in Korea, there's, compared to the population of South Korea, there's a pretty significant sized diaspora of Koreans around the world. Obviously, there are Korean Americans, but there are a lot of Koreans in Manchuria, right? In a couple of yeah. those provinces in Manchuria.
China.
There's a lot of Korean.
Mm-hmm. China.
What, like a few million probably, right?
Yeah, China has 56 official ethnic groups, with obviously the largest being the Han Chinese, you know, over 90% of the mainland's population. But one of those ethnic groups considered Chinese is Korean. So you can be Korean Chinese in addition to Han Chinese. Believe it or not, there's also Russian Chinese too. They're tiny, but the Manchuria region is where most Korean Chinese live.
Right, and there were a lot of Koreans originally in the Soviet Far East, but under Stalin in World War II, the potential loyalty of the Koreans in the Far East was questioned, and so a lot were moved to Central Asia.
Yeah, Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan in particular, but other parts of Central Asia.
Yeah, there's I know a girl that's a Korean from Kazakhstan.
Yeah, and so, and you had a lot. There were a lot of Soviet Koreans, and when I was in the Soviet Union, at that time, I was studying Russian, but I wasn't very good at Russian, but I was pretty good at Korean. And whenever I needed help, I would just look around, find a Korean, and then the Korean was always happy to help me and act as a translator for me. And that really helped me get around the Soviet Union back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the point I was going to make was the Koreans in South Korea, you know, they're not reproducing. They've got low birth rates. But one thing that they have done is they've wound up importing a lot of Koreans, ethnic Koreans. When you look at Korean immigration data, it looks like, oh my God, they're being flooded with immigrants. But you look at the breakdown, and these immigrants are from Kazakhstan, they're from Russia, they're from China. And they're actually ethnic Koreans. So they can do that. They can mitigate to an extent their demographic issues with by repatriating the Korean diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that I mean, there's obviously Chinese diaspora around the world. There are Chinatowns everywhere. I mean, you can go into these tiny tiny little towns in the middle of nowhere, and there's a Chinatown. Maybe there's only one person, but there's a Chinatown.
Yeah, every small town, there's going to be some Chinese takeout place.
There's going to be a Chinese takeout place. That's right. So, is there any evidence of a trend of the Chinese diaspora, which is actually considerable, especially like in Southeast Asia, it's massive. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence of the Chinese diaspora moving back to China?
Well, that depends. That depends on where the Chinese diaspora is located. If they're located in countries that are already hostile to the Chinese people, then there's definitely a bigger chance of them moving back to China. Here in the West, you know, especially in the U.S., I'm not sure. I think if anything will do it, will cause the Chinese to say, man, we're getting out of this hellhole called the United States. There's way too much violence and crime, you know, primarily from the black community. That's what will do it. Is the, you know, the black on Asian crime. I think a lot of the Chinese students who come to study and think, okay, maybe I can land a job in the U.S. because, you know, in a sense, it is easier to find a job and to compete in the U.S. because, you know, there's not as many qualified people in the U.S., whereas in China, everyone's, you know, a lot of qualified people, more competition, so a lot of them come here because there's not as much pressure and competition. But I think a lot of them, when they see the, you know, black crime, especially, you know, ones that have actually been attacked by blacks themselves, I think a lot of them will want to go back. I mean, at least their parents back home will be telling them to come back to China where it's much safer and more stable. But it really depends on where the Chinese person is located, where the diaspora is. Obviously, for the Chinese that are very comfortable in the West already and they live in the suburbs or wherever, I don't think they're going to move back anytime soon.
So I know this lady who runs, you know, a local gas station convenience store, and she's from Korea. She doesn't speak English very well, but sometimes I try to practice my Korean with her. And, you know, I ask her, why did she come here? And she mentioned, oh, well, you know, the competition to get into university is so difficult in Korea. So we came here, and, you know, I've got one son at Wake Forest. I got another son at, you know, UNC Chapel Hill. And I said, yeah, okay. But you're standing behind bulletproof glass surrounded by security cameras. Is it really worth it?
I guess it's in a very bad part of town or bad part where she,
I mean, if you're dealing with gas stations in, you know, in urban parts of North Carolina, that's what you're going to have. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's true. Cause I know in, Charlotte and, Raleigh, there's a lot of, well, actually, I don't know about Raleigh. In Charlotte, definitely, you know, it's just
Charlotte.
Kind of, yeah, it's just kind of like in Atlanta, you know, there's a lot of, ethnic Koreans in Atlanta. I mean, they kind of live on the, you know, the outskirts, you know, in Duluth, on the northeast part of Atlanta, but there's still a lot of, you know, Atlanta's got a lot of blacks you have to be careful for.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, obviously I'm the white boy summer, my dogs and I, my posse, we walk down Peachtree Street. And let me tell you, I don't think it's the same as it was 60 years ago.
know that it's strong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30. No one knows she'll be there, holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays a favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones. We got a thing going on. We both know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We gotta be extra careful that we don't build our hopes up too high. 'Cause she
obviously on the White Boy Summer, my dogs and I, my posse, we walked down Peachtree Street. And let me tell you, I don't think it's the same as it was 60 years ago. Not that peachy anymore.
Nope. The days of Ben Matlock are long over, unfortunately. It's like, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, America is the, I don't know how to describe it other than it's just a jungle wasteland of degeneracy and crime is what it is. I can't name a single, you know, city in America, a single, you know, stable city in America that doesn't have this black crime and liberal degeneracy everywhere. Not a single one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, hey. I want to shift gears a little bit because I got some questions. We had Mikhail Gorbachev die over the past week, and people who listen to my show regularly, if you caught my Thursday show, the whole show was a tribute to Mikhail Gorbachev. I was a fan. There aren't very many fans. I'm an endangered species, but I say I'm right and everybody else is wrong. So Gorbachev, you know, some of the rap against him as well. His reforms led to the downfall of the Soviet Union, the breakup of it, and then we wound up with a unipolar world where Zio-American power was not balanced by
hegemony,
another power, and so it just ran rampant. And you know, Jews took over Russia and ran it into the ground. That's what they say. And to me, it's like, well, Gorbachev, I think he was doing some things that were necessary. And like I said this on other shows, that you know, he wound up in a struggle with Boris Yeltsin, and he lost. It was a struggle that was not decided by military. It wasn't decided by bureaucracies. It was decided really by the people. The people, you know, a lot of events happened, but at the end of the day, the people clearly sided with Yeltsin over Gorbachev. And to me, it's all on Yeltsin. Yeltsin was the one who proclaimed the end of the Soviet Union. Yeltsin was the one who invited in these Jewish advisors and promoted this privatization scheme that turned the country's valuable assets over to Jews. It wasn't Gorbachev's fault. Now, having said that, okay, earlier this year we had a show about Tiananmen Square. And one of the things I mentioned in that show was Tiananmen Square, that incident happened in the wake of a visit by Mikhail Gorbachev to China. And at the time, the reporters were all saying, look, Mikhail Gorbachev has it right because he's doing political reforms, whereas the Chinese are ignoring the political reforms. They're trying to do economic reforms. Obviously, that doesn't work. And that's why, you know, Gorbachev is popular. This was 1989. That's why Gorbachev is popular, and that's why you've got revolution in China. Well, you know, in retrospect, it actually didn't work out that way. And some people say, well, you know, are saying the exact opposite. Gorbachev had it wrong by doing political reforms, and Deng Xiaoping had it right by doing economic reforms. And you can say that, you can make whatever case you want. But here's the question, right? So I said that there was a struggle between Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, and that Boris Yeltsin won. And he won because the Russian people sided with Yeltsin. In around the time, or short, you know, around the time, the late 1980s, I know Hu Yaobang had already died by the time of the Tiananmen Square incident, but you had Zhao. What was the
Ziyang?
Zhao Ziyang. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, did either of them represent a Yeltsin, somebody who was trying to push the reforms? Like, because Gorbachev was saying, "Let's do reforms," and Yeltsin kept saying, "You're not doing them fast enough. You're not radical enough. You have to do more." Were either of the Hu Yaobang or Zhao Ziyang, were either of them really a Yeltsin? Do you have a feeling for them?
I would actually compare them more to Gorbachev, which is, you know, my opinion on Gorbachev. I don't really have one or the other. I just think he was, you know, he was in that transition phase between, you know, from the Soviet Union to a, you know, the Russian, you know, whatever the parliamentary, not parliamentary, well, whatever Russia, the system that Russia has today, that's how I view Gorbachev. But I would say that Zhao Ziyang and Hu Yaobang was actually more like Gorbachev because they also wanted political reform. I wouldn't quite go to the level, I mean, they were not good people. These were, you know, Chinese, basically liberals in the CCP who wanted China to become a... essentially, you know, a puppet of the West in the sense of, you know, being subservient to the American, you know, U.S. domination.
Thank you.
They were not good people. These were, you know, Chinese, basically liberals, and the CCP who wanted China to become a, essentially, you know, a puppet of the West in the sense of, you know, being subservient to the American, you know, U.S. domination. But I wouldn't go as far as to call him Yeltsin because, I mean, Yeltsin basically just sold away everything, you know, to the United States, to the Jewish the United States and the Jewish oligarchs in Russia, you know, Zhao Ziyang, I mean, I don't know if he would have done that or not. Thankfully, we'll never know. And I think the Chinese Yeltsin, you know, because of the correct decision by Deng Xiaoping on June 4th, 1989, thankfully, we'll never know who the Chinese Yeltsin would be. And hopefully there is never a Chinese Yeltsin, is all I could say.
Well, anyway, so I'm not going to belabor the point, but I think Gorbachev is not treated fairly by practically everyone. So I will show for Gorby any day of the week, and that's my position, and I'm unanimous in that. Okay.
I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll say I guess Gorbachev. So essentially, what he did was he the Soviet government at the time was just a communist party of the Soviet Union controlling everything, and he essentially opened it up and said we can allow, you know, elections for multiple parties. Is that what it is?
Yeah, you eventually did. You had under Gorbachev, you had in 1990 an election for the what was it called, the Assembly of People's Deputies. There's a something of People's Deputies. I think it was the Assembly of People's Deputies. And it was not, you didn't have to be a communist. And so there weren't other political parties organized, in, I guess it was like March 1990 when they had the election, but you had over 10% of the people who were elected were independents not affiliated with the Communist Party. So you already had that start. And then a year later, the Russian Republic organized elections for its own parliament. And this is when the Russian Republic was still part of the Soviet Union. It was the main part of the Soviet Union. And that in that election, you had multiple parties. And Yeltsin ran for parliament, and this would have been the spring of 1991. And was it the spring of 91 or the spring of 90? Jeepers. Anyway, he won. in a district, in his home district. He was from Sverdlovsk, and he won. And then he got elected to be the Speaker of the Russian Parliament. And then he got the Russian Parliament to create the office of the presidency, and he ran for the office of the presidency and was able to win a contested election against Gorbachev's former prime minister, a man named Ryzhkov, and that election took place probably in June 1991, and that gave Yeltsin an electoral mandate that Gorbachev, he could have had one a year earlier because constitutional reforms he created established an executive president, and the executive president was to be elected in national elections. But the first election, because it was the spring of 1990 and everybody knew Gorbachev would win, and it just seemed like silly to waste 2 or 3 months on an election campaign when they needed to be concentrating on reforms. So they just had the Congress of People's Deputies elect the president, and so he wound up passing up on a chance to have that kind of electoral mandate, and that really weakened him later in his political struggle against Yeltsin, who had that popular mandate that he could point to. So mistakes. He certainly made mistakes. I'm not saying he didn't make mistakes, but I don't think things had to work out that way. And I guess it matters a lot to me, so I will talk about it from time to time. I don't want to. It probably doesn't matter nearly as much to a lot of people, so I don't want to talk about it too much.
Yeah. Well, y'all have to look into that, and then we'll talk about it maybe some other time. But. So one thing that I wanted to say real quick too, one thing I forgot to mention last week, actually, we did a show last week talking about there were these clowns at the Hoover Institution. One of them was, they were all neocons. One of them was H.R. McMaster's, the neocon, national security advisor of Donald Trump. And then the other one was Niall Ferguson, who was some, British elitist type that was, that was the one that talked about how everyone's going to die from COVID. And they were all talking about the, the downfall of China and how China's really in a bad position, which, go listen to the show. Neither one of them know what they're talking about. They're, just two clowns basically going back and forth about, China. But another thing I wanted to mention too about the Hoover Institution, a few months ago, George Soros was invited to speak at the Hoover Institution, and he did speak at the Hoover Institution. George Soros was speaking at the Hoover Institution talking about the, attacking China, basically talking about how much of a threat China is. So this just goes to show you, the Hoover Institution, which a lot of normie conservatives like to go to. It's a neocon. It's nothing but neocons is what it is. But this goes to show you that these conservatives, these neocons and certain normie conservatives, they will side with Soros against China when push comes to shove. So just wanted to mention that. Now that I mentioned it, it's kind of ironic how you had George Soros talking at the Hoover Institution, talking about how big of a threat China is. And then, last week you had the two clowns talking about, China's, not what it's made out to be. China's got problems here and there that, so goes to show you the double-mindedness of the ruling elite in the West.
So the Biden had a big speech in Philadelphia at Independence Hall. And,
it was very awful.
I mean,
that picture with just him standing there with a red background. I mean, he looks like basically a totalitarian dictator from a comic book. He looks like that one that one dictator from the V for Vendetta movie, which that's a pretty stupid movie in my opinion. I don't recommend seeing it, but he kind of reminds me of that picture of that.
Yeah.
That dictator.
I never heard of it. But
it's not worth your time or anyone's time. It's pretty stupid. But
I heard people talking about the optics. I heard people, you know, obviously talking about how he seems to be very threatening and menacing towards Trump, you know, MAGA Republicans, Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans being this massive threat. You know, and then Tucker Carlson was saying he wasn't talking about anything that people really care about. He didn't say a word about the opioid problem. He didn't say a word about China. So, you know, he's got that bug up his rear end still.
Yeah. I mean, Joe, a broken shell. That's all he is. It's the Biden administration, which is, you know, the Jewish power behind it that he's speaking for. And of course, you know, that power behind him clearly sees, you know, half of the American population as a threat that needs to be dealt with in the, you know, most harshest of ways possible.
I don't mean to be a broken record, and for our Zoomer friends out there, when you have an old record, it skips and it like will say the same words over and over and over again every 2 seconds or so. It goes on kind of a 2 second loop. That's what a broken record is. Just letting you know. But at any rate, I don't mean to be a broken record, but you know, we've got like everything's completely falling apart. And behind pretty much everything significant, every bad policy, you see Jews, right? And I don't mean to be a broken record, but you see them everywhere. You know, the Ukraine, you see the Jews, black riots. You look behind it and it's a bunch of George or black crime, a bunch of George Soros money and a lot of, you know, Jewish academics who are pushing forward all this critical race theory, all this, you know, white guilt stuff. Everywhere you look at the COVID stuff and so many, you know, it's not as if it was all Jews, but Jews were necessary. Without the Jewish media hyping it first and foremost, but you know, then you had these Jewish health officials in a lot of northeastern states, you know, like Richard Levine, who is now a 4-star tranny. Right. I mean, he is the assistant secretary of secretary of health and human services. You have these Jews at all these positions and Jews running Pfizer. You got a Jew running Pfizer. And so it wasn't as if it was all Jews, but even something like the Corona apocalypse, there was a critical mass of Jews. It wouldn't have happened without Jews. Everywhere you look, you see Jews and yet. People are still so timid to talk about it, and they want to talk instead about China or the New World Order or Agenda 2030 or just something else, anything that's different. They don't want to say the word Jews. Yeah. I don't think we'll ever get there.
Well, that's just, you know, for fear of the Jews, you know. For those who are Christian, that's a line in the Bible, for fear of the Jews. A lot of the, you know, people at the time, the Christians, they, you know, didn't say much. That. And because who was it? Who is David Duke's Jewish friend in the UK? What's his name? The saxophone player guy. He said that the evidence of Jewish
Gilad
power.
Osman.
Gilad Osman, yeah. Yeah, he said the evidence of Jewish power is the fact that Jews can control people, can shut up people talking about Jewish power or something like that.
The essence of Jewish power is the ability to stifle the discussion of Jewish power. He might not have used the word stifle, but that is basically what he said.
Censor the discussion of Jewish power. I mean, you know, the ADL has got to be the vanguard of Jewish power. That's what the ADL is. They go around and they censor anyone who tries to talk about them. And of course, you know, they this is the thing too, is every time you try to expose, you know, the, you know, Jewish war crimes against the Palestinians and the, you know, surrounding Arab countries and, you know, Jewish or Israeli, you know, secret nuclear arsenals being, nuclear weapons being created. The first thing that the Jews will do is they'll always invoke the Holocaust.
God.
Yeah, but like remember that there was a 60 Minutes CBS, there was a 60 Minutes CBS Australia documentary, which I'm surprised that actually got out. I mean, I was really surprised about this this one scientist who, you know, fled to Australia and exposed the nuclear, you know, Israel's secret nuclear weapon program. and you know, he was entrapped by the Mossad or by right. Israel through some kind of and arrested and sent back to Israel. And of course, you know, the Australian reporter, who's just, you know, your typical normie liberal type, probably, you know, was questioning this Israeli official, like, why do you think that's okay? You think it's okay to kidnap people, and you think it's okay to have secret, you know, not tell people about weapons of mass destruction? And then the Israeli guy just got, he just started, like, almost crying, like, look, haven't we already been through to endure this?
Haven't we been through enough? Haven't we been through enough?
Yeah, haven't we been through enough with the Holocaust? I mean, to have to hear. I mean, that's the thing. Immediately, as soon as you expose the Israel for having nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, they invoke the Holocaust to justify that. They say if we don't have these secret, you know, weapons of mass destruction to destroy the whole world, we might get Holocausted. That's essentially what they're saying.
Yeah, we might get Holocausted for real this time. Anyway,
yeah, for real.
For real this time, but for people who might not quite know what you're referring to, Mordecai Vanunu was a nuclear engineer. I don't know if you'd call him a physicist, but he was an engineer, and he worked at the Israeli nuclear facility, I guess in Dimona, and he wound up. I'm not sure when he converted to Christianity. He did convert to Christianity. I don't know if that's before or after he left Israel. But he got the plans for that the Israelis had used for their hydrogen bomb. Because, you know, hydrogen bomb is a kind of nuclear weapon, but it uses hydrogen in addition to plutonium or uranium. And he smuggled it out of the country, and he wound up in Britain. I guess he wound up in Britain, and then he got lured off to Italy, and it was part of a honey trap with the Mossad lured him to Italy because there was going to be some hot Italian chick there or something like that. But at any rate, Robert Maxwell was involved in this. Robert Maxwell is Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? Ghislaine Maxwell of Epstein fame. And he was heavily involved in arresting or not arresting, kidnapping Mordecai Vanunu in Rome, Italy, and then smuggling him into Israel, where he languished in prison for 25 years or so. And now he's no longer in prison, but he's forbidden from speaking to journalists. And
I wonder what's going to happen now that he spoke to this Australian journalist. Since if he's forbidden from speaking to journalists, yet he did. Hope he's safe. That's all I can say. I mean, he's pretty much, you know, trapped inside Israel, but.
His story's been public for decades. And I think Seymour Hersh, who is a Jewish reporter, Seymour Hersh, I believe, has written a lot about it. But his whole story's been out there. It's just that in the Western media, because of the
只有哆啦 A 梦可以带着我回 么实现梦想。可爱圆圆胖圆胖，小小叮当挂身上，总会在我不知所措的时候给我帮忙。到想象的天堂，穿越了时光，来，我们坐上时光机。快乐是与我分享，难过是陪在身旁，掏掏他的神奇口袋就能把烦恼遗忘。找传说的宝藏，冒险到远方，看我的任意门。啊啊啊，哆啦 A 梦和我一起让梦想发光。只有哆啦 A 梦可以带着我实现梦想。可爱圆圆胖圆胖，小小叮当挂身上，总会在我不知所措的时候给我帮忙。到想象的天堂，穿越了时光，看，是竹蜻蜓。
And I think Seymour Hersh, who is a Jewish reporter, Seymour Hersh, I believe, has written a lot about it. But all his whole story has been out there. It's just that in the Western media, because of the censorship, because of the self-censorship and the, you know, ADL censorship and everything, even though the information's out there, it doesn't circulate. And so very few people know Mordecai Vanunu. But, you know, he had and so they can maintain this fiction that, well, maybe Israel doesn't even have nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just surprised that, you know, it made it onto 60 Minutes Australia. Obviously, it's not going to make it onto the Jewish-run CBS in America. But 60 Minutes, I guess CBS Australia is, you know, must have slipped under the radar or something. I don't know. Yeah. So... But
in the Western journalistic world, it's not as if in order to get a job at a Western newspaper, Newswire, or network, that before getting the job, you have to undergo some sort of initiation where you're told explicitly that you can't talk about Jews and you have to like have sex with a pig head or something like that. There's nothing like that. And so a lot of people get into the field and they come from various backgrounds and they have various opinions and they learn about something like that and think it's going to be a good story and they try to do it. And, you know, the people higher up, tend to know a little bit more about what you can do and what you can't do. But, you know, this type of thing, yeah, it will get out. It'll get out from time to time. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't go anywhere. It's not going to lead to anything.
Although there was that CBS documentary on arming Ukraine that was pulled, that was canceled from the air.
Yeah. So that type of stuff goes on a lot. I mean, there is very effective censorship, but the censorship's not total and complete.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, yeah, it's been good enough over the years. That's the thing. It's been good enough from their point of view.
Yeah, and I think the reason why they pulled the arming Ukraine so fast is because right now the Ukraine situation is the top priority for the, you know, Jewish power structure in the United States. So that's like their number one thing is making sure that Ukraine does not fall to Russia, because, you know, Russia is a threat to, you know, the Jewish, you know, liberal hegemony, or the liberal New World Order, as some people call it. And they view that they need to act, they want to use Ukraine against Russia, but Russia is not going to let that happen. So.
And good on them. Well, anyway, we have come up to the end of the show, but I want to thank you for joining me, Cato.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on again. And, once again, happy Labor Day, everybody. You know, don't work too hard, but, you know, and, to all the children who are going back to school, please don't, whatever you do, please don't become a tranny.
Don't become a tranny and don't take the vax.
Exactly.
And don't wear masks.
Yeah, don't do any of that. Whatever they tell you.
Yep. All right. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Geek Radio.
China town, my child.